Hey, Trojan fans, it's time to get into the huddle with the Peristyle Podcast. The Peristyle Podcast is your weekly ticket to USC football and recruiting news. Don't forget, you can download the podcast 24/7 at our website, peristylepodcast.com. And now, here's the host of the Peristyle Podcast, USCFootball.com publisher, Ryan Abraham.
Hello, Trojan fans. Welcome to the Peristyle Podcast on a Tuesday. We're going to talk some USC Trojan football, some news on scheduling, Pac-12 stuff, lots of your questions. We've got a big show for you today. We've got Keely Yore in studio, Dan Weber on the line. We'll talk to them in a minute, but just to let you know, if you have any questions or comments for us, you can drop us an email, podcast@uscfootball.com. That's the email address. Or if you'd rather call or text us, we got some texts today, 424-254-9141's number. You can send us a text there or you can leave us a voicemail. Please subscribe on iTunes or any of the podcasting apps out there. Five-star rating is always awesome. Leave a positive review. Tell us what you think about the show and tell your friends. You got some USC football friends. The season's getting closer now. You can let them know we do the show all year round. And of course, when the season gets rolling, lots of cool stuff going on there. Well, let's welcome in Keely Yore. She's in studio. Welcome, Keely. How are you?
Hello, hello. I'm doing well. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. And Dan Weber on the line. Hello, Dan.
Howdy. How's it going?
You know, doing
back
all right.
Back from Bakersfield.
Yes.
So we're ready to go.
Dan and I were in Bakersfield on Friday night, which was fun, speaking at the Kern County USC Alumni Club. We had a great time up there. Some very cool people and people that listen to the podcast talked to us all about that. And then Keely and I were all doing recruiting stuff over the weekend, so it was kind of busy. I did the tour to Pier on Sunday. So got some more photo ops with Clay Helton. And well, I didn't take a picture with him, but my wife did. And Jake Olson, who were down there. And they had some random, they had some guy in a number 23 uniform, like full-on uniform with like a face mask that you couldn't really see his eyes. And I was like, I talked to him for a little bit. He was like some walk-on or something. I didn't recognize the name at all. But they had like a USC football player there, you know.
That's kind of random.
It was kind of random, yeah. I don't know what it was. But it was cool. Clay was great. Jake was great. His girlfriend and stuff were out there. We had a good time and, raised a lot of money for cancer charity. So thanks for anyone that supported my ride. There was 400 bikes there and our bike was we raised number six or seven of 400. So it was pretty good. So Jan and I both finished in the top 20 in fundraising. So my wife, we had a little contest, but I beat her. So
wow, well done.
Yeah.
Well done.
So yeah, for my first year, I was pretty excited to be in the top 20 fundraising. So we got a lot of topics and stuff we want to get to today, answer your questions. Before I do, I just want to thank Trader Joe's, who's been an amazing sponsor for us over the last couple of years. We love Trader Joe's, going there multiple times a week now. I've felt myself getting addicted to certain things. And then I like to go, if you go to their website, TraderJoe's.com, you can find something that's new. Now, I just found these, Keely. These look good. I don't know if they're gluten-free or not. Beanie Wafer Cookies.
Oh.
Or Benny Wafer Cookies. So they're like these little, so it's a Southern thing. They get it from Savannah, Georgia. But it looks like, it's sort of like an Oreo, but it's not more of a, a regular kind of cookie on the outside, not like a chocolate cookie. But there's like chocolate in the middle of them. So these little wafers and stuff, they look very, very cool. So I like going to the website, checking something out, and then going. Of course, I just buy it. Especially if it's a cookie, I'll buy it, you know.
Yeah, of course. My roommate actually came home with, they have different type of marinated chicken. You just pick up the marinade, different marinade, and you can just put it on the grill really quick, and you have chicken. So
yeah,
I'm definitely going to try that out. I didn't know they did that, but apparently they do.
Yeah, it's like pre-marinated, so it's already seasoned for you, so you just got to grill it up.
Yeah, easy peasy.
So really good stuff from Trader Joe's. Have you had those cookies? Dan, they're new, so they're just...
But I think they sound really tempting. Really, really tempting.
Yeah.
No, my good Trader Joe's news is they are scouting out for a location in my native northern Kentucky. So that's big news back in northern Kentucky that Trader Joe's looks like it's coming. So that's the good word.
Yeah, nice. All right. Well, we got a lot to get to today. So one of the things that came out, Antonio Morales, who's with The Athletic, does a really good job covering USC. Our friend from over there had a sit down with Steve Lopes. I think it was Friday or something late last week, and, you know, talk about the scheduling practices, how USC wants to schedule 7 home games per year. There was a lot of emphasis on this is how you make the college football playoff. And one of the big points of contention coming out of that article is that it's not easy to schedule FBS schools every year, and you want to try to get more home games, like you're saying. You know, they have the built-in one with Notre Dame, so, and you have 9 conference game schedules. So every year, every other year, it's 4 home conference games, 5 home conference games. And when USC has 4 home conference games, they get Notre Dame at home. So it's like 5, it's almost like having a 10 game schedule in your conference, 5 and 5. But then you got to figure out a way to get home games for the other 2 games, or a neutral site game every 4 years. But one of the things that came out of that, Dan, and Keely, get your thoughts on this too, is there's the potential for USC to play an FCS school, which was the old Division I AA, something USC has never done. USC, UCLA, and Notre Dame are the 3 schools that have never played an FCS school. But now it seems like that is on the table, and that sort of got USC fans not so happy about losing that. Losing games and stuff during the season is one thing, but traditions are important. And Dan, it doesn't seem like USC fans want to lose that tradition of never having gone down and playing a lower division foe.
No, and they shouldn't. However, you know, if you trade it off and say, we'll go to the playoffs this year, we might have to play an FCS team, what do you say? The fans would all say, well, of course, okay. Yeah. I mean, everybody else has played FCS schools, except, which is interesting, and this is why it's so, it grabs you if you're a USC fan. You, USC, and your 2 arch rivals, Notre Dame and UCLA, are the only 3 that have ever done that. But USC is the only school that has both of its arch rivals on that list. And so USC, that's almost a really special place. You wouldn't really want to drop off a list that's USC, UCLA, and Notre Dame, and then it'll only be UCLA and Notre Dame. That doesn't play really well unless – if you're in the playoffs most every year, you're dominating the Pac-12. I don't think the fans would care. And they care about Notre Dame, obviously.
Right.
But I don't know that they would care about that tradition. The problem is, I mean, it's hard to believe when you look, and I know let's face it, when they call the Athletic for a sit-down interview in Heritage Hall, bad news is probably coming out. And they're trying to slide it out as easily as possible as with the Lynn Swann kind of when he was, you know, really under the gun a few weeks ago and they wanted to have a long interview. And I think with Steve Lopes, the rationale is we got some bad news probably coming and maybe we got to get ahead of it. So let's tell somebody.
Yeah.
And maybe somebody who doesn't already have an opinion or hasn't reported on it or hasn't talked about it, and we'll kind of slide it out that way. So it looks like, you know, it looks like that's coming. I know there's some skepticism. If you're looking at teams that really qualify as FBS teams, and I was just looking at a quick list, any of the service academies, you would have thought that, you know, all of the service academies might enjoy the ability to come to Los Angeles. I mean, that's a big draw. And when you're a national, you know, school like the service academies, and they're not all, you know, tied into conference schedules that limit them, you know, so much. Or you've got schools like, you know, Marshall, North Texas, maybe, you know, Graham Harrell's school, Old Dominion, Rice, UAB, Texas San Antonio, Western Kentucky, the Helton's, you know, all of those would count as an FBS game. That would keep the streak going. Liberty, UMass, New Mexico State, Coastal Carolina, UTEP. And yet nobody, and you know, the rationale we're hearing is those schools just want too much money, that they know USC is kind of desperate to get them into this situation. And, you know, where they got to buy a game. And apparently that they've said they've, you know, more than doubled what has been kind of the, you know, because USC's got sort of a standard fee that you pay Utah State, UNLV, who else has been, Western Michigan, you know, teams like that, Arkansas State. And they say the price has gone way, 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 way up. And, you know, that's, USC's in a tough place. You wish they had probably developed some better relationships with the likes of San Diego State, Fresno State, UNLV, those schools that aren't, you know, that far away that could easily, you know, justify a trip to Los Angeles because they recruit here so much. So so I don't know. There's not a lot else they could do other than if they could convince the Pac-12 to go to an 8-game schedule. And then you've got 4 games to play with, like the SEC teams do. And maybe USC and UCLA should go together and try to, you know, push the you know, Pac-12 really hard there. But I think there's some news coming down the pike in the not-too-distant future that's going to have some teams on there. And we're talking about teams like Eastern Washington, Northern Arizona, Cal Poly, Cal Davis. Those schools, I think, would be my guess, is what you're looking at.
Yeah, and it's funny, Dan. If this was, there's 3 programs that have never played an FCS school: Vanderbilt, USC, and Boston College. I don't think people would care, but because it's Notre Dame, UCLA, and USC, you don't want to be the guy, you know, the program that drops off of that list. And you know, it sounds like I'm agreeing with you on this. It's sort of like a preemptive strike. They're going to throw that out there, like, hey, we could end up playing an FCS school, and then here we are, you know, here they announced playing an FCS school.
We told you.
And, you know, it's one of those things, like, you know, we're seeing all these other programs scheduling games really far out in advance. It's been a few years since we've seen that happen from USC. So my guess would be, Dan, that this was something that you're figuring out a problem too late. Like, oh, crap, it's too late now. We can't schedule some of these. Old Dominion's already scheduled or whatever. They've already scheduled this out 10 years ago. We needed to get on the ball, you know, 2-3 years back and do that. So, you know, if they're trying now, that's one thing. That's great. But I feel like this was probably a mistake that was made a few years back. So there's going to be some holes that they didn't fill fast enough. And maybe they change their philosophy and all that. But to say it's like, this is how you make the playoff when you really haven't seen, you know, if you really want to make the playoff, then you got to pitch to the Pac-12, like you said. Hey, 8-game schedule, that's the ACC and the SEC are always in there. They have 8-game conference schedules. If you really want to make the playoff, that's the way to go. So it seems like a little bit of a mixed message coming here, Dan.
Yeah, and you know, maybe the solution is it down the road to go the Notre Dame route. Notre Dame plays half of an ACC conference schedule. And then they've got the ability to you know, schedule to their fan base, and they can, you know, schedule a game in San Diego, and they can schedule, you know, in New York City, and they can schedule in, you know, Baltimore or Philadelphia, wherever they want to go. Notre Dame has got that kind of, you know, freedom, and you just wonder how many of these things you keep adding up about staying in the Pac-12 make sense when we look at the other stuff that's happening in the Pac-12. You just wonder if USC, you know, needs to get it together. Obviously, USC needs to do what USC needs to, you know, to do before maybe worrying about the Pac-12. But maybe you need to see the, you know, see them come together. But it makes it awfully difficult. You know, I mean, and it clearly when UCLA is announcing that they're going to do home and homes with LSU and Michigan and, you know, Georgia, whatever, all those really good games. And there have been a lot of really interesting games announced for Pac-12 teams in the last couple of weeks. You would hate to be USC coming on and saying, well, here's our new schedule opponents, and they're going to be FCS teams. Doesn't exactly, you know, that's not a PR, you know, that's not a good day PR-wise if you're USC when you're going to come on and announce you're going to break the tradition and you're going to add. And it's probably, you know, the difference between Western Michigan and, say, you know, Eastern Washington may not be, you know, much at all. But it's just the idea that you're giving up on something that's really mattered to USC. And, and Notre Dame and UCLA. And you hate to be the one to give that up of those three, because probably no reason for Notre Dame and UCLA ever to do that. And I think you wish USC would just bite the bullet and figure out, we got to get this done no matter what it takes. And we're not sure that that's happening.
Yeah. All right. So we'll see what happens there. Dan's premonition is, though, if you're a big USC fan and you love the fact that they've never played an FCS school, Dan is thinking that's going to change at some point. So we will see. There was an article from CBS Sports that came out today that I wanted to go over with both of you guys. So they basically ranked all of the Power Five head coaches and in the Pac-12 specifically. So I'll kind of go down in reverse order. So Mel Tucker, the new coach of Colorado, he's actually 64th of 65 overall, number 12 in the Pac-12. Jonathan Smith, Oregon State, they hired him in 2018. He's 63rd, just one spot ahead of him, 11th in the Pac-12. This one's interesting. Herm Edwards at number 10. His first year, he actually finished second in the Pac-12 South and went 7-5, but they have him 54th overall. Clay Helton is 51st overall, a couple of spots ahead of Herm Edwards. He's number 9 in the conference. Justin Wilcox, number 50 overall, number 8 in the conference. Mario Cristobal is number 7 from Oregon. He's 41st overall. Kevin Sumlin at Arizona is number 40 overall. That seems a little high for what he's done. Mostly, you know, some of the A&M stuff, but he's 6th, so he's in the top half. Mike Leach is 5th. He moved up after having an 11-win season last year. He's number 20, though, so he's 20 overall in the Power 5. Kyle Whittingham, number 4. This is too low for sure. He's number 18 overall. This one I probably have the most issue with. Chip Kelly, number 3, 14 overall. We'll talk about that. Dan wasn't a big fan of hiring Chip Kelly. I thought he was going to be the best coach available out there, but he was at Oregon in 2012, and he went 3-9 last year. I'm not going to put him ahead of Kyle Whittingham in the order there. Then number 2, David Shaw, he's number 9 overall. And Chris Peterson, they have him as the third best coach in the country, number 1 in the Pac-12, which makes sense. But Dan, get your thoughts on that. We'll get Keeley's too.
Yeah, I would agree with Chip Kelly. I mean, I think you if you're going to drop Clay the way – I think they dropped him 20 spots for last year – I think you got to do kind of the same thing for Chip Kelly. And I think it's not just, okay, they had the USC game, but other than that and the recruiting effort and just the sense about the program, maybe it's harder to drop guys. I don't know. Why, if you're going to drop Clay 20, I don't think there's that much of a problem. You know, I agree. I don't know what Kevin Sumlin has done even at Texas A&M to warrant, to be in the top half of the Pac-12. I don't see it at all. Certainly didn't see it at Arizona. Let's see. As far as David Shaw, again, I think there might be some erosion there in terms of where they're going and where that program is going. In terms of the holding on, I probably wouldn't have him that high. And Chris Peterson, just has that, effect on people like, Reed Arbord. I mean, he's the guy USC passed over, and that forever enshrines him as one of the coaching greats of all time. I mean, I don't think that's just how it works. You've done it, obviously, a good job.
That and the winning, the winning helps too.
But you do a good job at Washington. Washington's a good job. I mean, he's done a good job. He's in the Pac-12, though. I mean, I think people just – you ought to be in a program like, Washington or USC, you ought to win in the Pac-12. I mean, for a while it was like, wow, the North is so tough. And you think, the North is tough? I mean, come on, it's the Pac-12. But I would kind of agree with you on the ones that look like they're overranked. Last year's season for USC was bad enough. The UCLA game was so horrendous. The fact that they didn't get better at all, they didn't compete in so many games where they just lay down and, gave up 34 straight points and had no answers at all. A little bit in the Arizona State game, which they lost, but they cut the offense down and they were a little more focused for Jack Sears. And then they got focused for JT Daniels in the Notre Dame game, and they decided to go with their strengths and go all out and make a commitment, you know, to throwing the ball. And if they don't put it on the ground a couple of times and what have you, they, you know, but again, that was game 12. And yeah, I don't know that you're getting paid $3.2 million. You probably ought to have your team show up before game 12. And that just didn't happen. So, you know, these rankings or whatever you want to make of them, but it's hard to argue them other than, you know, on the margins a little bit.
How about you, Keely? Anything stand out to you?
I kind of agree with everything you guys said. I didn't really get why Chip Kelly was so high. I also thought Kevin Sumlin being number six was a little too high. I always just think about the 18 flag palooza at the end of the USC game. That was just a brain drain. But, you know, I think Kyle Whittingham deserves to be higher, especially higher than Chip Kelly. But, you know, rankings are kind of weird that way. But I agree with everything you guys said. I think it's just not really agree with all of it, but.
It's funny. I got in some arguments with some people on Twitter, and there's some people who are like, Hilton should be 12th. I'm like, well, he still won the Rose Bowl and he won the Pac-12 championship. And then some people are like, well, Chip Kelly should be that high. Well, because he did something, you know, 8 years ago. Like, it's weird that they try to use a double standard. And it's all subjective, obviously. Yeah. But they want to try to use the, like, I don't like, you know, I think Chip Kelly is a really good coach. But from what I've seen, and there's questions from real UCLA people are like, this might not work. And to give Dan credit, he was saying that from the beginning where I was like, no, he's going to kill it. He didn't kill it last year. Now, they got better. He didn't really try to recruit very hard, and that's the whole point of being at UCLA. They're recruiting better now. I think they're going to be better now. But just from that and what he did at Oregon 8-9 years ago, I'm not putting him above, like, a Kyle Whittingham who's in and, you know, every year he's taking a lot less and doing a lot more with it. So, I mean, you could argue Whittingham's number two, like Dan was saying, behind Peterson.
Yeah, you know? I could almost argue that he's number one when you consider – what each program, you know, Washington against Utah, you almost might say, you know, Whittingham, that there's nothing to, you know, choose between Whittingham and Peterson, that they're right there. But yeah, there's not a 1-4 difference, I don't think, at all.
No. And then some people will throw in, like, well, USC has more talent, so they're going to – so the people are kind of judging on a scale. Like, yeah, USC should have certainly been better than the talent than 5-7 last year. It's, you might ding – you know, Clay Helton more for going 5-7 with way more talent than you would ding like a Justin Wilcox or something. But they actually did. They went 7-5, I think, and went to a bowl game, right? So yeah, that's so it's the whole do more with less or less with more. So that all come into play. But for Chip Kelly, it's just like, that's, for me, that's just too high right now. As someone that came in thinking he was a really good hire, I just felt that's too high.
Yeah. Do you think Herm Edwards deserves to switch places with Clay Helton? He's one below, but I mean, ASU had a winning season.
They finished second in the South, you know, and like there was, and yeah. I bashed him as much as anybody.
Yeah.
But it came away like, now, I think we'll have a better feel this year because they did have like Manny Wilkins. They had a lot of veteran leadership and N'Keal Harry. I mean, he inherited like a really good team, a team that finished second in the Pac-12 South the year before, and they still fired their coach, which was baffling. But now it's like, okay, but I feel like he's put a really good staff together. They're recruiting well. So I don't think there's going to be some huge drop-off. So, yeah, that did seem a little low to me. I don't know. What do you think, Dan, about Herm?
Yeah, I did. Actually, I was surprised, although I don't know that people were excited about his team that's coming up this year. So, I mean, I don't know if that played into it, you know, a little bit or not. And you know, he beat USC. He had a winning record. It would be – I just think they're in wait and see mode, I think, with Herm. Get a little more evidence in, but yeah, that probably surprised me a little bit.
Yeah, I guess they can't. Yeah, whatever. I don't know. We'll see. I think I've turned. I'm not saying like Herm Edwards is going to be the greatest coach, but he's done better than I thought. So I don't want to like keep bashing him just because I started bashing him. You know, it's like, hey, yeah,
that's good.
There was also yesterday a Pac-12 conference call, sort of a news dump. In the Pac-12, the financial statements were released. We got there was a call with Larry Scott, who, as you know, is the commissioner of the Pac-12, but also the CEO group that was there. So it was Philip DeStefano. He was he's the chancellor and chair, chancellor of the University of Colorado, but he's the chair of the Pac-12 CEO group. So both of them spoke. There were some questions. Dan asked a question, but it was kind of a dullish call, I guess you could say. A lot of just, you know, hype speak and stuff. They said, oh, we're all excited about this. We're excited about that. But Dan, what did you think about that call overall?
Yeah, I would be a little nervous if I'm like Dave Hurst, vice president for communications, and I go out with a a conference call, and Dennis Dodd got on right away and asked the appropriate question. You take in $497 million, you distribute $354 million, which is by far the lowest percentage of revenue distributed to the members of the Pac-5 schools. And what's the deal here? Why do the Pac-12 schools get a lot lower percentage? And Larry always goes to, well, we have our own network and nobody else owns their own network. And so you can't really compare us to anybody else. And, you know, if you take our network out, blah, blah, blah. So that was a good question. Okay. The next guy, you couldn't hear him. And at this point, I'm thinking, I don't know if I really want to ask, because you're not going to get probably an answer that's worthwhile. But it was sort of like a mercy. I hit the star one, and there I go. I get the next question because they can't hear the number two guy. So I asked Larry. And the thing I've got to wonder about is the Pac-12 needs an infusion of cash, and they're not getting it from their TV contracts, the 12-year TV deal that's been passed by everybody else, and they're certainly not getting it from the network. So they're trying to sell off like 10% or whatever number, we really don't know for sure where these negotiations are going, to private equity guys who would own a part of the network's media rights. So basically all 12 schools are going to toss in their media rights and merchandising and all of that and hopefully get an infusion of cash. I think originally they were talking $750 million. Now they're maybe $500 million. Nobody knows what those rights are worth. And the question I've always got is, so USC throws in all of its media rights and merchandising and all of that, and Oregon State throws in all of its, and each of them take out the exact same amount. Each of them get a 12th. And I'm thinking, how smart is that for USC or UCLA or Washington? I'm not sure. But the second part of that is, if they make a deal and they do get the $500 million, which they distribute to all the schools to try to make up the gap between the, you know, the SEC and the Big Ten for what each school is getting per year. How long does that go? I mean, is that in perpetuity? I mean, could you leave the Pac-12 and still leave 10% or however much of your rights forever with these investors who bought them? Well, Larry didn't have an answer for that. And that's the kind of thing, you know, we've got to work out or whatever. One would think that USC and UCLA wouldn't do any kind of a deal that would bind them past the 2023-24 year when all the TV contracts are up. I would think, you know, and we understand that the new president, Carol Folt, was there, and that was a lot of the talk was what are they going to do about, you know, getting this kind of infusion of cash. And you just hope USC does not give away, you know, rights into the future. Because I know Larry, one of the things he said was, well, a lot of these schools have signed more than 12-year contracts now. And that's the last thing USC and I think UCLA want to get locked into is this super long deal where even if they leave, they can't take their rights with them. That would be, I think, really, really foolhardy. But that was about it as far as the news. There was no mention on the call of the fact that even though the Pac-12's revenue is down and down from projections and the distribution to the schools is basically flat, Larry Scott went from $4.8 million a year to $5.3 million a year, plus a perk that he can travel first class whenever he so chooses. And from what you understand, Larry so chooses, he will go first class. just a guess.
Yeah.
When they don't charter a private plane, but it's not a good look. I think the other part of it is interesting. This is the second press conference in a row, including the one in the basketball tournament in Las Vegas, where Larry has had a minder sitting there. It's not just Larry now. Larry's had the chancellor of the Pac-12 CEO group, Phil DeStefano, from Colorado, as his in there with him. And it's interesting, that would have been Max Nikias. Max Nikias was named for this year. Max was to be the chair of the Pac-12 CEO group. And USC, that would have given USC some leverage and some maybe ability to influence things. So in his leaving the USC presidency, that also took Max out of being the chair of the CEO group. And I think he had kind of figured out, as many people have, that that Larry Scott hasn't advanced the cause of the Pac-12 all that much. But anyway, that's where yesterday left us.
Yeah, and there were some, you know, John Wilner tweeted out and put out a story like the financial breakdown earlier. And so you felt like Larry Scott was sort of like trying to be, he said they were going to be more transparent because we did more than the actual minimum, because the Pac-12 would do the very minimum of what reporting was and make it really hard to try to figure out where all the money is. But well, now
for years, the schools themselves were not permitted to have that information. Yeah. Or when the athletic directors last year said, we'd like to see the financials, they were told, you can't have them. The athletic directors at the Pac-12. So now they're going to dump all this information out. I think they realize sports writers aren't accountants, you know? And you look at all these numbers and you just think, okay. And they just say, oh, well, we're doing comparable to the other conferences. And that's just totally not true. I mean, it's not even remotely close to where the Pac-12 stands with regard to you know, the Big Ten, the SEC, and the Big 12. It's amazing that the Big 12 shot by the Pac-12 without a championship game and without a network. And then the ACC is starting a new network this fall with ESPN, which will put it past the Pac-12 easily. And so, you know, when Larry came in, you know, he got that first big deal with ESPN and Fox that got the Pac-12 to number one overall. And now, by next year, he will have seen the Pac-12 go from first to fifth of the Power Five conferences. So they've gone back down to where they were when Larry came in.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that's a record that you should be getting, you know, $5.3 million. And I saw, I guess, Jim Delaney finally at the Big Ten finally got paid for all of the stuff he's done. I think he had a big bonus last year, which got him above Larry. But normally, in most years recently, Jim Delaney had been making, you know, about half of what Larry's been making. But he got, looks like, a one-time bonus that pushes him just barely above, you know, above Larry. But for producing so much more wealth, you know, for the Big Ten. I know you got into a little bit with the Iowa people.
Right? I got, so, you know, sometimes I'll get on Twitter and I'll like just push some people's buttons and make them mad. And I did that yesterday. So, you know, there's some fan bases that are really, you know, I don't know, Keely, are the Angels fan bases sort of like very sensitive? Like if you say something like, hey, we won the World Series in 2002, like, do they
no,
get, like,
we're defeated.
Okay. Defeated.
We're but very there's, sad.
So like Iowa is a really nice program, you know, they're probably top 30 in the country or something. And they actually have really good revenues. They're probably top 20 in like revenues and stuff that they're generating or whatever. But, you know, it's Iowa. They live in Iowa. You know, Iowa City has 76,000 people. One of the things I tweeted out, I'm like, Iowa City has 76,000 people. The 405 freeway has 400,000 cars on it per day. Like, that's one of the freeways in LA. So just trying to go out. But the point was, the Big Ten in 2018 distributed $54 million to each school. The SEC was 43.7. The Big 12, 36.5, and that doesn't even include their local TV rights. So they're ahead of the Pac-12. And the Pac-12, like Dan said, stagnant, 31.5. $3 million. So about $23 million per school less for the Pac-12 than the Big Ten. And so what I tweeted out was like, so USC, a blue blood program in the number two media market in the country, is making $23 million less or made last year from their TV rights than, I said, Rutgers, Maryland, in Iowa, just picking, like, you know, basically anyone that's not my point was anyone that's not Michigan or Ohio State, that would make sense. Well, the problem is, well, a couple of problems. One, well, Iowa fans are crazy. We'll go over that too. But first thing, Rutgers and Maryland still don't have full shares and they're borrowing against it. They might not have shares for years, full shares. So that was kind of a point of contention. But you could throw in Purdue or Illinois or Northwestern, any of those schools that aren't like traditional powers that aren't in like huge markets. USC is making $23 million less than them. And Iowa I threw in there too. Now, of those programs, Iowa was the best football wise, pedigree wise, but they're not Michigan. They're not Penn State. They're not Ohio State. But Iowa fans were so upset that I mentioned them in the same breath as Rutgers or Maryland. And they're
that's what got them mad.
Yeah.
They didn't want to be in the same mention with those. They don't even want to count those teams as being part of the Pac or Big Ten.
Yeah.
They know they brought those two in for the New York City and Washington, D.C., Baltimore TV markets. And that's the only reason. But, yeah, if you remember, when USC played Iowa in the Orange Bowl, their fans were – it was like, you know – who is USC? How do they even think they have a right to play us? We're the Big Ten teams. We're Iowa. It was like, wait a minute. You people, we kept trying to tell them in the run-up to the Orange Bowl, you don't know what you're talking about. There's no comparison. It was like they hadn't heard of USC. I mean, it was like the strangest fan base in terms of how they perceived themselves.
Yeah.
And then it was obvious in that game that there was no comparison. I mean, it was just they had a 5'11 quarterback who
Brad Beggs,
who was a player of the year for AP, and he couldn't out, you know, Carson Palmer, you know, was like 6'5 and 225 pounds, and he could outrun Banks couldn't outrun USC's, you know, linebackers or tackles or whatever. It was like, you know, it wasn't any contest in terms of football players. And then when you look at tradition, it was like, have Iowa people not watched the Rose Bowl or what? I mean, did they really – they were not happy that USC was even in that game. It was like, they don't belong here. Who are they?
And then they got
smoked. It was a very strange reaction.
And then the weird thing, too, is like – so they're, you know, they're tweeting at me and they're like, really, it's just, I'm like, look, I tell them 10 times, this was not a shot at Iowa. Iowa is just the only, I'm grouping anyone that's right. Not Ohio State or Michigan. They're anyone in the, like, they're not a blue blood program in the Big Ten and they're not in a big market. They're going to make a crap load more money than a blue blood program in the number two media market. Like, that's the whole point of the story.
Yeah.
And, but it was just this real defensive thing. Even Zach Johnson, the, you know, what did he win the Masters? Like the, he tweeted at me, like at the, he like tweeted
really?
Like, yeah, like he put a map of the best college towns in America. And California had San Luis Obispo and Iowa City was the best in Iowa. Which I don't know how many college towns there are. There's two Ames. And
Zach Johnson went to Drake, for God's sake.
He's from Iowa, right? Like, he's a big Iowa.
Yeah, I think so.
But yeah.
Drake is in Des Moines. Yeah, he's from Iowa. But yeah. That's funny.
It was pretty funny. Like, that's like the kind of stir that started, where all these people are going crazy. And they're like, well, if you look at Iowa the last several years, first of all, they said they had two tight ends drafted in the first round this past year. Like, yeah, okay, yeah. That means you're a better program than USC. But I mean, most people were like, fine. But there were some people that are like, if you look at the last 10 years, Iowa's won almost as many games as USC, and they haven't had the same kind of recruiting classes. And I'm like, okay. I'm like, dude, for the last 10 years, the last decade or so, has been a down year for USC. And they won three Rose Bowls and two conference championships during that time. Like, Iowa went to a Rose Bowl and got smoked by Stanford during that period. So that's like USC's worst is like winning three Rose Bowls in 10 years, you know? And it's like absolutely baffling that they were getting some of these arguments. Yeah. I'm like, look, Iowa's a good, I mean, fine program. There's nothing wrong with it. It's good. It's like, but it's not a blue blood, and it's in a very small market. Someone had to tell me, like, oh, Iowa owns the Chicago market. I'm like, what? That's like 250 miles away. I mean, it was just like some of the arguments were just baffling. I don't know what to do. But
can I just jump in here and say to the nice people of Iowa, I'm not a part of this. Do not at me.
Keely does not like. See, I like Iowa. Keely's not a fan.
False. That is false. I have family in Iowa. I'm just saying.
Keely could not.
I have
point
been
to
caught
Iowa
up in some fan bases sometimes, and I'm just saying I was not a part of this.
I should tag you.
No, do not.
Zach Johnson, PGA champion. You. It's Keely's fault.
Yeah, I'm the mastermind behind this.
Nice. But yeah, so the moral of the story, the Pac-12 makes a lot less money. And then what does that really mean? Well, okay. I mean, the best example I can come up with is for Purdue, they have the hot coach Jeff Brohm, and he wanted to go back to, everyone thought he was going to go back to Louisville. Well, Purdue makes a crap load of money now. They could pay him more. They can pay his assistants more. If USC was going to go try to hire him or some assistants, it's going to be a lot harder to do that, taking people away, because they're not going to have the same kind of budget that these other programs have. Non-traditional powers are going to have a lot of money to be able to keep. If they have a hot young head coach, there's more of a chance you can keep them. And, you know, if you're Alex Grinch and you're at Washington State, Ohio State can just come in there and pick him to be your plan B defensive coordinator, not even your main one. So those are the kind of things for me are going to be an issue, that you can't keep assistants. Because even a team that's not at the same level of whatever team you're talking about in the Pac-12, if it's, you know, if Oregon State and Northwestern were on the same level, like Northwestern can do more than Oregon State can just because they're going to be more money. And same thing, you know, USC and Ohio State, you know, USC might not be able to get someone for Purdue that traditionally you could get, because now Purdue's making way more money on TV deals.
Or USC can't pay an FBS school to come in a guarantee game because the SEC schools, let's say, can pay a whole lot more, or the Big Ten schools can pay a whole lot more. And if USC is trying to get one of those same teams, the market rate has gone way up, and where the Big Ten, the SEC can pay that, USC can't. So
that's a really good point. Yeah.
It's hitting you in a lot of different places.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens. I know some people don't care about money, but I just, it's not a good trend when the bottom dwellers of the Big Ten are going to be making $23 million more than USC and UCLA and Washington and all that. So, all right, probably enough Pac-12 finances. We should get to some questions, I guess, Keely, right?
Yes, we actually have football questions, which is exciting.
Yeah.
We have a couple questions from Steve in Poway. He says, which graduating senior from last year's team will be missed the most by this year's team? Note, he does not need to have been the best player who graduated, but the one where there will be the most drop off this year.
That's a good question.
Probably off the top of my head, I'd just say Porter Gustin, just because he had huge production, even though he was hurt most of the time.
You could say he was missed already in 2018.
He was already missed. Yeah, it's kind of proven he was missed.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, I mean, I think I do think Aaron Osmus, in terms of the weight room, kind of brings a little bit of that Porter Gustin vibe. So I think they probably got, they moved in the right direction there when you take Porter out of the weight room. I think Biggie, I think Iman, you just weren't that successful. You know, all the stats show that you weren't that successful trying to throw against him. And, he was a physical kid, and, he gave, USC kind of a physicality that you haven't seen. I think, as much as Cam Smith was a leader, I think, in his weight loss and trying to, trim down, and I think some of the physicality may have gone away. And I think Cam and Porter kind of got it, almost looked like they got tired out trying to bring the team with them. There was just a sense of, we keep trying, they need, they're just not necessarily listening to us. It was kind of a tough year for Porter with his injuries, and Cam just, wishing they could see things kind of the way he did. But I would probably go with Biggie Marshall.
All right. What about you, Keely? What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a good call by Dan, especially just given the depth and experience with the cornerbacks. That's just a big question mark going into this next season. And I think having a guy like Iman Marshall return would be huge because you have that veteran-ness continued, but obviously he's not going to be there. So I think that is something that you're really going to miss for USC's defense.
I think Dan convinced me to double down on Porter because I was just thinking about all the sacks, but he's also like the leader in the weight room. So true. That's like double. So yeah. I'm Dan, you convinced me.
Okay.
So Steve,
we're all going to miss Porter. I think this team, might have better, more influence on this team for some, and I don't know why the chemistry feels the way it does. I just get the sense that these guys have reacted to last year in a very positive way. It was so awful. And they're young enough and physical enough and all of that that I think what happened last year, you know, just Porter wasn't able to maybe change the course of things. I think this year he would have been. So yeah, he'll be missed without a doubt.
So Steve has another question. He says, likewise, which new player, i.e. freshman or transfer, do you think will have the most impact this year, including special teams?
Well, I think you got two right now. I mean, you got the punter, Ben Griffiths, and you got the Drake Jackson. I just think, just with the ability to make that one-of-a-kind sort of a defensive turnaround play as he did with the one-handed, interception where how did he get there? How did he get to the ball? How did he catch it? How did he convert it? Those two, I think, just jump out at you as the two newcomers that will be on the field and will have an immediate impact. They're just that kind of player. So anytime you can get that's a really good thing.
I think there's two answers. Those are them. So
yeah, I would say those two. Or if you want to go a different route, maybe Drake London, given how many receivers Graham Harrell wants in an air raid ish type offense. Maybe there is a spot that Drake London can come in and kind of carve out a spot for himself. Not sure, but. Question mark. We have another question from Nick Kearns. He says, my question is in regards to the offensive line coaching post Pete Carroll. Can you rate or put in order from best to worst the O-line coaches past Pete Carroll's days? Drevno, Connolly, Summers, Craig, and Callaway. There's some spelling errors here. Sorry. To me, this has been one of the biggest issues of USC's success or lack thereof. 2011, 2017, and 2018, they had good years as well as good to great offensive lines the other years. It lacked. Oh, sorry. Maybe spell check, people. it lacked either because constant change, lack of motivation, etc. Can you elaborate on your valued opinions? Keely and Ryan, feel free to chime in.
I might plead the fifth here a little bit. I think so much of what the offensive line coaches do have to take into consideration what's the whole offense doing? How well is it, is it thought out? How much does the head coach want to practice, physically? We see them, they're over in the one corner and they got their sleds and they're, working on their own stuff. So we kind of see them as kind of separate entities, but they're really not. They're part of the overall, team approach to football. And I don't care what, Neil Callaway did last year. I'm not sure that was all going to go together in any way. And I do think, the offensive line coaches in offenses that just haven't had their stuff together have been a little discouraged, in terms of, how they coach them up. But of that group, you've got three or so that really just didn't succeed here. I mean, they just weren't able to, make kind of any sort of impact. And, I think obviously, Drevno and Summers, have had the opportunity, to make it work. And I think we'll know, I think we'll be able to evaluate that really well with the addition of this year's information that we see with Drevno. He likes this group. He thinks they're really athletic. He thinks they're talented. He thinks they, you know, compare favorably or better than any group he's had other than the 49ers. So I think, you know, and they're coming in with nobody thinking any good thoughts about him at all. I get the sense that they want to be good and that they know what it takes to be good. I think we've seen in recent years kind of teams that wanted to talk about being good but didn't necessarily seem to understand what it took to be good. And you can put that on the, you know, on the coach, you know, for sure. But I think they've kind of scrambled around to figure out how everything goes together. This year, it looks like it, even with the, you know, the whole different approach to things, it looks like it goes together in a better way. Now, Drevno is learning that, you know, the offense, his kids are learning the offense. It certainly looks like they picked it up. It certainly, you didn't see, you know, the indecisiveness. You didn't see the false starts. You didn't see, you know, the kind of penalties. Having, you know, Pac-12 officials there every day, you know, certainly helps. But so I would say Drevno's got a chance to separate himself, you know, from the rest of the field. And I think there are three guys in that field that just didn't have a successful tenure at USC. And then, you know, Coach Summers, I thought, was a real professional and had some, you know, some decent, you know, guys to work with and did a pretty good job.
Yeah, I think the big issue was there was a 6-year period where they had a different coach every year or two coaches. I think he's put Craig, it's James Craig is the one he was talking about. So he was there for 3 years, I believe. And he's actually with Ed Orgeron now at LSU. But then, you know, Kiffin brought in like Mike Summers to like coach along with Craig when there was a, you know, real strong argument that Craig should have been fired, but they just like, it was like Kiffin was defiant. It's like, no, I'm not firing him. I'll just bring in another coach. So there was just a whole bunch of weird decisions made on the offensive line front. But, you know, I think Zach Banner had 6 offensive line coaches in his 5-year career.
Yeah.
Like it was crazy. And then you bring in.
And probably didn't listen to any of them.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Zach didn't need a coach.
But then you bring in Neil Callaway. So, you know, not, you know, someone that's a lot of people would argue past his prime that wasn't some. It wasn't like a young up and coming offensive line coach or some established, you know, he was just, you know, it wasn't the right fit. They've just made a lot of bad decisions.
But the weird thing was he'd really done a good job at Western Kentucky and he'd had guys, you know, guys playing in the league and guys who'd really, really, you know, become very good players at Western Kentucky and played well against the likes of LSU and, you know, Vanderbilt, people like that. And then just, got to USC and just nothing happened.
Yeah. But like you said, part of that's the offense was gumbo too, you know? So there was, yeah, it's a mess. So Nick, yeah, it's been a comedy of errors as far as USC goes. We'll see what Tim Drevno can do the second time around.
Yeah. I mean, out of all the many coaches that you listed, Zach Banner had, the favorite he had was Tim Drevno. So you never know.
Oh.
Yeah, so we'll see.
All right.
Nick Kearns also left another question. He says, my question is, who is the one freshman you are looking forward to seeing in fall camp who can be the Drake Jackson of this group? So I think he's suggesting the incoming freshman.
I mean, I think Keenan Christian. I mean, we're watching him on tape run track. And we're thinking, first of all, I didn't know he was that thick. Okay? I look at him and I say, you know, this is very Reggie Bush-like, you know, kid looking like coming out of San Diego. This is a thick football playing looking guy. And you just, I had no idea he was really that. I mean, he's faster than Reggie. I mean, to start there. I want to see what in this offense they can do, just get him the ball in space quick. And what happens? I don't know. But I don't know if there's anybody in the Pac-12 that's any faster than he is. And USC hasn't had that guy. USC's had, you know, guys that had decent speed. And Adoree was just sort of in a completely separate athletic category. But this kid, you know, has got the kind of speed USC hasn't seen. And I'm just really looking forward. And I don't know that until track season I would have thought that. But watching his performance in track is, what did he have, a 10.19 wind aid at 100 that didn't count, but he's below Reggie in the low 10.3s. And I'm guessing he's going to drop that a little bit more in the CIF, championships, but he's really impressive.
Yeah, I'd say him. The only other one you could say is Drake London if he was completely healthy, but you're going to see him more later on, I think. So yeah, I would go with Kristen for sure.
Yeah, I would too. Chris Trevino and I are actually working on a video with Keenan, and we got to see his track meet a couple weeks ago, and just seeing him in person run, it's just so easy for him. It's ridiculous, and he's just so fast. He's a grown man. He looks so just grown, and he's 18 or whatever. And we watched his workouts, and he just brings a professional mentality to his workouts and how he. I haven't seen him play in pads yet, but he just has this professional mentality, and I think that's something that USC needs in the locker room. So I think that's could be a potential Drake Jackson in the future.
Yeah, and he was just a 3-star, right? Is that one of those ones?
I think he was a 4-star.
I think he might have been 4.
Did he get up to 4? I just thought he was one that might have been overlooked a little bit.
In the composite, he's a 3-star, but 247 has him as a 4-star. But he's the 30th running back in the country.
Yeah, he's exciting. Again, it's speed USC has not hit, and what you saw with Reggie, it matters. There's something about it. If you can play football and you have that kind of speed, it really matters. I mean, there are things you can do. I do think they will have some special plays for him. I think all the stuff we didn't see in the spring is the stuff that JT called the shot plays, where you take a shot. I think some of the shots they're going to take are going to be with Keenan, and I'm just going to be interesting to see, how that works out. I think I really like the possibilities though.
We have a question from Mike from Arizona. He says, looking back at your comments regarding spring ball, I was super excited to hear Clay was finally addressing the discipline or lack thereof and by bringing Pac-12 refs to practice, especially the part about them explaining what they were doing wrong. It has been so frustrating over the last few years to see plays called back and potential momentum swings shot down. Also happy to hear about the increased intensity and having fun again. My question is, can they hire refs in August to continue this education? If not, what can Clay Helton do to keep that focus moving forward, especially with Mr. Drew Richmond coming to town and his well-known false start problem? Thank you and fight on, Mike from Arizona.
That's a good question. I don't know what the limitations are in the August practice going in. I know, we've seen officials in August. Hey, that's a good question, and you would think if you're a Pac-12 official, that's your way to get better and to get, up to speed. So you would think you would want to work games. I know in basketball, they regularly, hire college officials, to do, especially all the scrimmages and that. But that's a good question. I don't know. Can you do it every single practice in August? That's a good question. I absolutely don't have an answer to that. I don't know if there's some limitation, say by the Pac-12, where you're getting too close to the season and all that. That I don't know. We'll check on that. That's a good question.
Yeah. And, having a little bit more Pac-12 money would have helped that too, I guess, but we digress.
Yeah. We got a text from Justin in the Crenshaw area. He says, love the show. I would like to learn more about the structure of the USC athletic department. Who works under Swan? Who are sports finances? How are sports finances? What aspect of football makes the money? Ticket sales, TV?
Let's see. I think the budget, in talking to finance, I think the budget's up to 110 million, something like that. USC is a private school. They don't have to turn over all the books and all of that. They do have to do their IRS 990s, but you don't always, you don't see exactly, you don't have the USA Today does all the, you know, the budget and what have you of all the schools. And with Stanford and USC, schools like that, the private schools, you sort of are guesstimating. But if they're only getting, say, $31.3 million from TV, you know, you're talking about another $80 million that has to come in otherwise. So from, you know, donations, development money, ticket money, you know, basketball, obviously some there. Unfortunately for USC and the Pac-12, you're not getting, you know, half of the revenue or the bulk of the revenue from your TV deals and all of that. But USC has, gosh, I'm trying to think the last time we counted the number of employees for the athletic department. It's there are way more people working for the athletic department than you would guess. And I'm trying to think, did we get up to 140 or something like that? I guess there aren't as many after the FBI came through. There's still, you know, a lot of money, you know, a lot of people raising money, a lot of people, you know, overseeing a lot of, you know, different sports and facilities. Steve Lopes is the chief financial officer and chief operating officer. And so he would be nominally the number two person. And then number three is gone. Donna Heinel was the number one, you know, the top women's administrator. And then you have people over, you know, like, you know, sports media, Tim Tassalone, and the sports fundraising is Ron Orr. And then, you know, you have a lot of people, you know, assisting them. You have people, you know, running the business office and the facilities people, and there are a lot of people. It's a pretty big enterprise, and they basically break even in terms of the books. So, you know, if it's like, you know, they take in $110 million and they spend $110 million. You're not putting any money away if you're in college athletics today, no matter what. Other than that, I don't think I've got a good answer in terms of, you know, how you want to break it all down. It's just USC's kind of in the middle of the pack. I think they spend about as much money on football, 40 some million, as say Clemson. So USC and Clemson, now probably a lot cheaper to run a football program in Clemson, South Carolina, than it is in Los Angeles. But USC would be, you know, in that area. I don't think they spend as much as Oregon or Washington. Certainly don't spend as much as Alabama, which is like $69 million or whatever it is on football, or Ohio State, or Texas, or Texas A&M. LSU, USC is not, you know, in that ballpark at all. The you know, $50 to $60 million ballpark. That's not where USC is. But they're not so far out that they, you know, they can't be competitive.
We just went over the hour mark, so we'll try to. We got a bunch of questions left, so we'll try to like kind of get through these a little bit faster. So. I blame Keely.
Of course, blame me. So Jim B is a little frustrated, and he wanted to let us know. He says, "Why are the trustees still holding a job at SC? Hiring Pat Hayden was a bad decision. Hiring Lynn Swan is starting to look like a bad decision, or at least his decisions so far haven't been good. Hiring Sark was a bad decision. The board of trustees had the final say on that decision. Clay Helton wasn't the guy one would hire, at least not if you're looking at his past resume. They passed up a lot of good coaches to hire Sark and Helton. The decision to not fight the NCAA in court was a bad one. The Coliseum renovation is a joke. Why would you go from 92,000 to 77,000? Usually you add seats. Has any major university redone their stadium with less seats? Isn't that going to cut down on crowd noise? And what about the people behind the glass inside the structure? You wouldn't even be able to hear them. Don't you want crowd noise if you're the home team? Fight on, Jim B."
Well, Jim, at least you've got the sound from the rest of the people bounces off the windows of the Coliseum tower. So maybe that'll help. I don't know. Some schools gone down? Yeah, actually, Arizona State went from like 75 to 53 in their $300 million renovation. Cal spent $328 million or whatever on their renovation, and they went from, I think, about 75 to I don't know if they, maybe 60 now. Is there a pattern here? I'm trying to think of who else in anybody else in the Pac-12? Stanford went from 84,000, tore that thing down, terrible old stadium, and they put a new one up for 50,000. So there does seem to be a pattern in the Pac-12 of going the other way. In the SEC, nobody. In the Big Ten, nobody that I can think of has gone the other direction. So in the ACC, can't think of anybody that's gone in that direction. But the Pac-12 kind of going in a different direction. As far as Board of Trustees making those decisions, I think there are so many people on the Board of Trustees, and I think it's up to 57 voting members now. A lot of them not in the U.S. I don't think they're hands-on. I don't think you'd want a hands-on board of that many people. I think you got to trust the people, the people you entrust to be the president and to make those decisions. And the president's got to entrust the people with the expertise in the different areas, that we're talking about. I think one of the problems is USC has hired people who had very, very little expertise in the areas they needed to have expertise. I mean, we can thank goodness that the airlines do not hire pilots the way USC hires athletic directors or football coaches. That would not be a good, you wouldn't want to be on those planes. And you hope your surgeon is an expert in what he's doing. But USC hasn't kind of gone that way, and it's bitten them in the butt. And we'll see what happens, with the new president. There's been pretty good churn already in terms of, the top executive suites at USC, and we'll see where that goes. But I think you got to trust the people that are running the university to know what they're doing and to know that they're doing what's really good for the university. And I'm not sure, that's been what's happening exactly, that those people. And I don't know that, the president of the university has to really understand football, but you got to have people around him who do or understand, architecture when you're talking about the Coliseum, or understand, the LA fan base, or just a lot of things that you need to understand. And I just think for some reason USC has been lacking at that next level where you need the experts to be, and the people making the final decision, or at least okaying the final decision, haven't gotten the best information that they needed to get.
So we have an interesting email from Rich. He says, when the subject of Urban Meyer comes up on the podcast, it seems like you guys don't like the idea of him being coach. Why? Yes, he's got some baggage. So do most of USC's previous coaches. Look at Pete Carroll. He was an unsuccessful NFL coach. One was an alcoholic. What is wrong with you guys? You don't want a winning coach? Seems like you'd rather stick with Clay Helton and spend all day complaining about him and the team. Hire Meyer.
Rich. Nice. It's funny. No, Rich, I'm just, for me, if USC has a head coaching vacancy, I just want them to hire the best available guy. That very well could be Urban Meyer. I mean, he's, if you hire him, you have a pretty good shot at winning a national championship. I'm not like anti-Urban Meyer or anything like that. I just want them to go out and just hire someone at the level that USC should hire. And that just hasn't happened. So, I got no problem with him. Rich, I know there's some moral things there, but I'm fine. I'm at this point, I'm just beyond all that. It's like, fine. Just he's available. He's in LA. You need a coach. Get Urban Meyer.
Yeah. I mean, I think the whole issue is the timing right, with his, what happened at Florida, what happened at Ohio State, kind of the nature of those things. Does that make it difficult, to come into the USC situation with some of the things that have happened with people here at USC, and in kind of the Me Too, culture of today, where does that, some people would say that's a fight USC doesn't need to have. The flip side of that is, how often has USC hired someone like that? I guess the answer would be never, unless you count Howard Jones, who had won a national championship at Yale and was Newt Rockne's pick. And then we'll give him credit. USC tried to hire Newt Rockne. And Newt Rockne said, I don't think I can come. I'm staying at Notre Dame, but here you ought to hire this guy. Who was that? Where do you think Howard Jones was, Ryan, when USC hired him?
Iowa.
Iowa. There you go.
Wow, here we go again.
Maybe they're still mad. You think
I read your
still
book.
Mad?
Or is it, was that in your book? That was in your book, right?
All
right.
Yeah. He was actually from right outside of Cincinnati originally, but went to Yale, you know, All-American, won national championship there, and moved around a lot. But I think Iowa was his last stop, and I guess he was had the Hawkeyes on the verge, and then here comes USC and swooped him away, you know, stole him away. Other than that, USC would have never made a move like an Urban Meyer move, and that would be an interesting move. It would change the culture for sure. And sit back and watch. I mean, I think the first thing you got to say is, I hope they go on. You know, if you're a USC fan, you probably got to be saying, I hope they go undefeated, and Clay Helton moves from number 51 to number, you know, 4 or something on the list. That would be, I think, the preferable way to go for everybody at USC. But there are people who inexplicably almost seem to be rooting against USC in order to clear everything out and move in the right direction. I don't think, you know, I couldn't do that, and I don't see how anybody could, but it certainly seems like that's out there.
Yeah, I don't understand how you can come away with the fact that we don't want to cover a winning team. I mean, that's always so much better than covering a team that's 5-7.
Yeah.
And I also just don't think Pete Carroll's baggage is comparable to Urban Meyer's baggage. No. So I just don't feel like that's a good comparison there.
Yeah.
We have an email from Dan, class of 1962. He says, thanks for keeping the Coliseum fiasco front and center. I do have a solution for the empty seats with no view of the field problem. Mannequins. Dress them up in USC colors and change to Ram colors on Sundays. From the blimp, they will be seen as spectators. Or you can go to the Weekend at Bernie's route and connect their arms to string in order to do the wave. It would be a great sight from the air. Do you remember when USC and other colleges did card stunts at halftime? It could also be a card stunt section that is permanently in place. I would also like to know the thoughts from all of you about the proposed...
Robots.
Yeah, robots. There
robots.
You go. The proposed NCAA rule to allow college athletes to benefit from the use of their image, the O'Bannon lawsuit. This will be another case of the NCAA having no clue, but USC may have an advantage being in the LA advertising market. Your thoughts on the mannequin/card stunt proposal and the payment of athletes for the use of their image in games and advertising would be appreciated. Fight on, class of 1962, and old enough to remember great card stunts at halftime.
Hey, real quick, that for Dan, this is a great idea, by the way, the mannequins. But I think what you could do is there'd be some promotion where, hey, you're going to come to the game by yourself. Here's a free USC mannequin. You just have to put them in one of these dead seats. So you can take the carpool lane to get to the stadium.
Oh, true.
And then you put the mannequin in its seat. Then you just go pick it up afterwards and drive home.
Perfect.
You like that?
Like people rent, you know, they rent those cushions for their, you know, yeah, their seats. And, you know, they're there. Well, this one, you could bring it with you. And maybe it gives you the right to have a drink at the, you know, in the tower. And
don't push it, Dan. You can't do that.
Believe it or not. Oh, I think my first trip to Orange County, I was for a bowl game or whatever. Somehow I ran into a guy whose company made mannequins for crowd shots for the movies. Honest to God, I think it's the only company in the world maybe that was making mannequins. I've actually met that guy. I don't know where he is now, but he was at the Fashion Island. He had his offices at Fashion Island, but he made mannequins for the movie. So I don't know if he's still in business or not, but that's a great idea, Dan. Thank you very much. And maybe you could kind of dress them up in their own, you know, maybe give them a card section. If you could get animatronic ones, they could do little card stunts and what have you. That'd be really great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do that. What about the whole Ed O'Bannon lawsuit and whatnot, Dan?
Yeah, I mean, it does give an advantage to certain places, schools, if you're, you know, if they're going to say, because, I mean, what they're finding out now are these kids are now more maybe in basketball or some of the football kids in the Southeast, they, you know, have their own websites. And they, you know, I mean, if you say you were Lori Loughlin's daughter going to USC, what, Olivia Jade, and she was being paid all kinds of money to be an influencer on her blogs and, you know, with products and what have you. You think these kids who were really, you know, highly, you know, visible, you know, high school football prospects couldn't, you know, develop those kinds of opportunities? I don't know how they, if they can regulate them or not, but it would be, you know, I find it hard to imagine that the NCAA could go down that road too far, because the potential for what would happen in certain places if certain kids were allowed to monetize their image or, you know, their brand would be off the chart. I mean, with in certain recruiting battles, let's say. I mean,
yeah, it could get a little, nutty.
Oh my goodness!
But it's hard to say. It's like your image, but you know, someone like Juju that was really good on social media, you get a whole bunch of followers. Well, you can get, you know, paid. You know, if you tweet something, you can, it's like you're promoting something. Like you can get paid for things like that. You know, to review a product or things. I mean, there's like a whole this would be open up a whole new world and potential. There could be some potential problems. Yeah.
I mean, you know, just say, I love my new Nike, you know, cleats, or I love my, you know, workout gear by so-and-so or whatever. I mean, you don't have to think too, you know, far down the road to figure out where that would go. I mean, if, what was it, the Loughlin daughter had 2 million followers on Facebook and 1 point something million on Instagram or whatever, and had all kinds of products who were, you know, paying her to be an influencer. That, I don't know where that goes if you put it into college sports. Man.
So we have one final email from Guile Smiles. He says, there have been much discussion about the decline of high school football in general in California and other blue states, with less and less participation because of its perceived violence and potential for injury, etc. Meanwhile, in the red states, and specifically the South, the warrior culture of old continues to persist, and high school football shows no sign of slowing down as a rite of passage for those cultures. In your opinion, is there truth to the saying that red states produce national champions in football, while blue states produce national champions in water polo and volleyball? Please discuss.
You know, I mean, I would think without a doubt the best high school football programs in America are in California. I mean, you know, the 1-2 programs right now might be Mater Dei and Bosco, and I don't think anybody's close, to be honest. There isn't. I mean, Texas high school football is fabulous. The stadiums, the amount of, you know, interest in the, you know, the fans and the, you know, the towns and all of that, there's never going to be anything like that. In California, I don't think quite with that, and the same with you know, Georgia and Florida. They're in a, you know, in a different place. I would say, you know, with the Southeastern Conference, for example, every state's different. Tennessee's kind of dropped off in terms of high school football not being what it was. You don't see that at, you know, Kentucky, Missouri. I mean, a lot of the Southeastern Conference states, you know, don't have you know, great. Necessarily great high school football, and nobody right now has programs that can challenge you know, the very top programs in California. I mean, it's not even close. I mean, Mater Dei in the last few years and Bosco are just so much. I mean, I've told this story before, but my Cincinnati St. Xavier High School team won the Ohio State Championship, I guess, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and they played Bosco in the opener in Cincinnati, and Bosco beat them like 35-6. I mean, it wasn't a game. Bosco was so much farther advanced in terms of just the physicality and depth and top end talent and the offensive, you know, sophistication and all that. So I think there's you got to look at it different ways. There may be, you know, slightly fewer, you know, kids playing football in California, and one of the reasons is, there are so many other sports you can play. I mean, you can play baseball 12 months a year. You know, there's no place with better high school basketball, even though they don't have the big gym. So I think it's a more sophisticated analysis that you need than just, you know, the South has got the warrior mentality and all that. And yeah, they do have spring football that comes first, and they practice in pads, and baseball waits till spring football is over, and those kinds of things. I mean, you know, they will kid you that they have two seasons in high schools in the South, you know, football season and then spring football season, and everything else is afterwards. But so it's a challenge, and it's a challenge for the West Coast. I don't think there's any question. But the West Coast is the top end talent and the top end high schools. You throw Bishop Gorman in there. You throw the team that probably started kind of modern great high school football programs, Concord De La Salle. California is a big part of high school football nationally, and you're not going to get away from that. I mean, they're just getting better and better. I mean, however many coaches, Bosco had something going on a week or so ago, and you had coaches from everywhere, you know, came in to, you know, see what was going on. So, so I think that kind of an excuse for, you know, people maybe not getting the job done, but I don't think it's an excuse for saying that the West Coast can't compete.
Yeah, Kayla, get your thoughts on this too. But we cover a lot of these high school events. They're as big as ever. There's 7-on-7 every weekend. I if there's going to be less high school football, it's probably some small program that would never produce a Division I player anyway. Like the programs that produce Division I players, they're still around and they're thriving. So I don't see that as being an issue, at least from what I've seen. I don't know. Do you get that sense, Kayla?
Yeah, I definitely don't. I mean, just being at the I went to a passing tournament this weekend, and you're seeing Bosco and Modern Day, and they take football very seriously. And They're doing spring football now. They're having spring showcases, and college coaches are coming out and evaluating players. I mean, even just Orange County in general, the sports mentality there, growing up and playing sports there, it's insane. Like, and you have the money flowing in. Like, parents will pay a lot of money for their kids to do sports all year round, and the warrior mentality is there too. Yes, it's different in the South, and that's true, but football is crazy down here too. It's unreal. And I mean, Modern Day won the national championship, so it's also, you know, it's serious here.
Well, the other thing is, and that you didn't ever see, and when I came out to California, I don't think we'd ever seen private coaches before. I mean, that was unheard of. I mean, your high school coach was your coach. Now, you know, these kids, private coaches, in some ways are maybe more their coaches than there just wasn't a market exactly, back home for private coaches. That's not the case in California. They get private coaches, you know, are just extremely important and, you know, high quality, people. The idea, I mean, there's a reason so many of the top quarterbacks come from California. I mean, you know, you got the athletes and you got the coaches and you got the great weather. They don't have to, you know, worry about, you know, playing in the, you know, the snow and the ice and the rain. And they just, you know, they do more things 12 months a year. And it kind of shows. I think, you know, Orange County is a perfect example of, you know, high school football. I don't think it's dropped off. It may have dropped off at, say, Long Beach Poly, for example, and whether that's coaching or what it is. They were the number one program for producing NFL players and all of that, and may still be. But there's a reason that Modern Day is, I think, one of only two high schools with two Heisman Trophy winners. And the other one is a military prep school that didn't exactly have just high school kids. So, I don't think California's dropped off at all.
Yeah.
This might be an overgeneralization, but do you think offensive linemen or just lineman mentality is different in the West rather than the South? I feel like linemen in the West are kind of just low-key, like, they're mellow guys, you know, they're kind of the funny guys in school. I feel like it's just different from the guys we see that come out of the South and whatnot.
Yeah, I think that's the flip side of all of the upside of the 7-on-7s. I think the downside is a little bit more, you know, you get more sophisticated, you get more, timed up, you get more skilled players doing all the things that you do in 7-on-7. But, and I know, you know, now they're doing more, a little bit more lineman kind of 7-on-7 stuff. But I think for a while that sort of slipped through the cracks. Well, what are you doing for the lineman? You know, if you're doing a lot for the, you know, the skill guys, you know, on the defensive, you know, secondary linebackers, what are you doing for the guys, you know, up front? And, I think that got lost a little bit. You're right. There were kind of the, you didn't have the hard grunt guys. You didn't see that on the West Coast. And that wasn't the case for years. USC, I always thought the first times I ever noticed them were for the offensive, the big athletic offensive linemen who could run. And we haven't probably seen those as much recently, with the ability to dominate. And, you know, you probably need to do a better job of that. And I know the kid from Folsom, who was a first-round draft pick, who went to Alabama and started as a freshman against USC, you probably got to try to keep those kids at home. I know he was sort of an Alabama kid, but you got to figure out a way to keep – when you get guys that are that good, you got to figure out how to keep them out here. But yeah, I think you're right. The offensive lineman might be the one place, and maybe those really big, thick linebackers like Pala'ie – maybe you haven't seen as many of those out here as you might see, you know, in the Southeastern Conference.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's more ready-made players in the South. You're seeing more than here. There's more projecting to do. But if you look at the like I interviewed Jeffrey Percy from Jay Sarah over the weekend, and he's 6'7", but he's like 260. And you know, he knows he's going to put on weight when he gets to college. But I think the stat was like four of the top five offensive linemen drafted were like 250 pounds in high school. So they weren't ready-made guys that came out. You know, they weren't 315 pounds and 6'6 coming out of high school. And, you know, it takes a little bit more. Maybe it's a little bit more of a crapshoot, but it's more of an evaluation process where you have to figure out these guys. They're athletic enough. Oh, they do shot put. They're discus throwers or they play basketball. And they're 6'7" and 260. We can put weight on them, and they're going to be an all American offensive tackle. So I think there's some of that too, but that's harder as for coaches because you're putting more emphasis on evaluation and, of course, developing those players.
And specifically for Percy, he's a tight end turn tackle.
Yeah.
So it's not even like he's a guy who's been doing this his whole growing up. He's a tackle. No, he was a tight end.
Yeah, but he's aware that, like, you know, in this draft, this last draft, I think it was four of the top five offensive linemen. They weren't 300 pounds in high school. You know, yeah. They were 250, 260, something like that. So, all right. Yep. Well, I think we should probably wrap it up here. How long did we go? We went pretty long.
Usually.
Yeah, close to an hour and a half.
Congrats if you made it this far.
Yeah, not too bad.
Tweet at us a pineapple emoji if you did.
For off season, tweet us a pineapple emoji. Okay.
Yeah, a little insider.
Little off season hour and a half podcast. That's not too bad. I mean, a lot of questions, a lot of good topics to kind of get in the beginning, but thanks everyone out there for listening. We're going to actually just got a confirmation, our live show on Wednesday. You know, if you like first round draft picks and All-Americans from USC, Lawrence Jackson is going to join us on the live show.
Ta-da.
So that should be fun. And our State of the Union, June 1st, Saturday, June 1st from 3 to 6 at Common Space Brewery. That's still going on. Send us an email. Let us know if you can make that. We got a lot of people coming. Arash Markazi is going to be there. Bruce Feldman is going to be there from The Athletic and from Fox Sports. Arash, obviously, from the LA Times, former USC Daily Trojan writer. Lawrence Jackson is going to join that, too. And Jake Olson is coming out to that. So I got to see him over the weekend, like I mentioned. Cool stuff. Hope you guys can make it June 1st free. Just come, you know, but whatever you want to. They'll have food outside, food trucks and stuff. And then it'll be, you know, beer, lots of different beer selections. If you like that sort of thing. So, but you know, you buy your own, but you don't, there's no charge. We're not buying all your beer and everything. I might buy you a beer. Come up to me and say, hey, I listen to the podcast. I'll buy you a beer. How's that?
But, wow. More secrets if you listen all the way to the end.
So only if you tweet a pineapple emoji at us and then you say,
that's ticket for free.
And then buy a beer, and then I'll give you a free beer. Yeah. If you do that. Awesome. Well, okay.
And the good news is with the Ross, you usually get, dancing girls, right? He usually brings his own. So, you know, don't miss it.
Yeah. Nice. All right. Well, that's Keely Yore. I'm Ryan Abraham. And that's Dan Weber. I don't know why I said me before Dan. Sorry about that. That's Dan Weber. That's Keely Yore. I'm Ryan Abraham. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Peristyle Podcast, and we will talk to you next time.
You may have noticed that shopping at Trader Joe's is unlike shopping at other markets. People ask us all the time how we manage to have such unique, interesting, and delicious products at such great everyday prices. This is Dan Bain of Trader Joe's. The answer is simple. It's all in the way we do business. We buy directly from the manufacturer whenever possible. This helps to keep our costs low, and we pass those savings on to you. No gimmicks, just great values at honest prices every day at Trader Joe's. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Peristyle Podcast, presented by USCFootball.com. Be sure to tune in next week for the latest news on Trojan football and recruiting. Don't forget, you can automatically download the podcast directly to your smartphone or tablet for free. Just click the iTunes link on peristylepodcast.com or search for Peristyle Podcast at the iTunes Music Store.